Welcome to the Revenue Builders Podcast, a weekly show featuring B2B sales leaders and executives. Hosted by five-time CRO John McMahon and Force Management co-founder John Kaplan, the show goes behind the scenes with the people who have been there, done that, and seen the results. If you enjoy our content, please subscribe, rate, and review the show to help us reach more people. Revenue Builders is brought to you by Force Management. We help companies improve sales performance, executing the growth strategy at the point of sale. Find us at forcemanagement.com. Enjoy today's episode. Hello, welcome to the Revenue Builders Podcast. Today we talk selling to the economic buyer. Joining the team for the conversation is Carl Froggett. Carl is currently the CIO at Deep Instinct. And prior to that, he spent 17 years as the head of global infrastructure defense and the CISO of cybersecurity services at Citi. He's been the economic buyer for some of the biggest deals in tech history. Also joining the show is Joe Lynch, who's the sales director for the East at Deep Instinct. Joe sold to Carl at Citi prior to being his colleague. So in this episode, the two of them sit down with John McMahon and John Kaplan, and they talk through what works, what doesn't, and how you effectively sell to the economic buyer. It's a great conversation. Here we go.
So Johnny, I'd like you to say hello, and Carl and Joe, I'd like to introduce you to John McMahon. Thanks
for coming. Hey, Carl. Hey, Joe. How are you today?
Hey, Mac.
So, Carl, so much is on the line when an account executive first meets with you and your company. And when you first meet an account executive, like, how do you decide if that account executive understands your business, isn't wasting your time, and they're just, you know, throwing out features and functions of their product?
Well, I think you summed it up there, Mac, right? They're too generic. So an immediate thing that I look for is not the vendor bashing, which is especially in the tech space, not just cyber, that's where they start. And that's just a turnoff for me. Why? That's my job, right? Mm-hmm. My job is to ultimately evaluate what is best for my company at that point in time. So let me come to that conclusion. But the number of times, Mac, I've had an account executive, get a meeting with me, especially somebody who I don't know, or it's easier if it's a vendor that I do know or have a prior relationship with, obviously. But somebody new, it's very hard. So that initial meeting, the number of times I have people kind of start with the threat landscape of cyber and how it's bad. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, this is literally what I'm paid to do, right? Like, get to the point. And sometimes, I remember one time, I kind of gave a gentle nudge of, yeah, I've got this. You know, can we get to the value prop? And they didn't take it. They had a script and I could tell they were following the script, and it's just a turnoff. So, wow. I think for me, it's about doing a bit of research. Who am I? Right. And it's totally fine to ask me questions. Right. So, for example, if you're on the threat landscape, which is normally where cyber companies start, you know, is this good or do you want me to skip? Right. That's totally fine. Don't waste my time. I don't want to waste yours. And you can see that straight into the, you mentioned the product sell. It's a product. What's the value? What does it mean to me? What does it mean to my business? How is it going to support what I need to do for my company? Is more what I'm interested in initially, more than the tech even, because the tech eventually will get into the detail.
And how many times do they come in, Carl, with a compelling viewpoint? If they don't have a champion and they got in to meet with you first, how many times have they done enough homework on your business that they come in with a compelling viewpoint?
Rarely. Yeah, you kind of, there's usually a competitive kind of piece. You know, you've got a firewall vendor and there's 10 other firewall vendors. Maybe they've done their research, for example, in who I already have. Pretty easy to do, even though we're not, you know, we're generally not disclosing who we do business with. But, you know, LinkedIn and whatever is a great source. but rarely. And like I say, it's very generic. Which is just a turnoff, because I feel, from my perspective, I see vendors as partners. Let's start there. I could not be successful in my job without vendors. I cannot protect my company without cyber vendors, without analytics vendors. So this is how I always view my success is built in a large part with choosing the right vendors, and therefore it's a partnership. So you coming in and just not even bothering and just being generic and like I say, not asking me questions, it's just an immediate, I can read it. I can Google it, right? Why are you here? You know, I can do this at any time.
And in those rare instances where somebody did come in with a compelling viewpoint, what information were they armed with that kind of differentiated them from the thousand of other salespeople that came into your office?
Yes, we have Joe here, and Joe and I have a bit of a history, so I'd welcome his perspective.
Brace yourself, Joe. Brace yourself. It's coming.
Get ready, Joe. It's your turn. I want to let Joe kind of talk a little bit because he did some good research. But he came in. He understood my priorities, which was interesting because it was the first meeting. And I clearly could see, even in that first meeting, that, Joe, you need to give me some names, right? He had information that he necessarily shouldn't have had about what our problems were, what our business priorities were, and then how his company could help address those. And I want to be clear there, it was how his company could help address them. It wasn't his company versus, all the competitors. It was the value that they could bring. And they weren't demeaning to other companies, to other vendors, right? They were just telling their story and how, as a partner, they could actually help me be successful and therefore my company be successful, right? So I'll pass it over to Joe. So I'm sure he has a totally different recollection of how easy it was to get a meeting with me.
Had to get a couple of gatekeepers, huh, Joe?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I got recruited back to my previous company by Mike Ernest and Dave Goodmark and co, who taught me this really solidified value-based sales process and approach, they let me know that Carl's previous company was the only global financial that didn't have any current spend with us. So roll your sleeves up, follow the process that we've built here, and let's go get some new business meetings, do discovery. So I leveraged our tech partnerships with the CrowdStrikes of the world, Microsoft, Accenture, Avanade, and I probably had 20 to 30 external and internal discovery meetings on how we can best position ourselves for what Carl Fraga cares about. Because every feedback I got from those vendors is that everything in cyber at this bank starts and stops with Carl Fraga. And if you don't make a great impression in that first meeting, you may not get time with him again for the next 12 months. So the four pillars that we knew that this company cared about in network, end user, security, and cloud, I did my homework on those people, what their priorities were, had a few internal discovery calls at Citi. And when we met with Carl, we were able to position how this will be successful for all four of those pillars, right? If they were to go through my previous company and what problems we could solve for them.
Hey, so I want to just
go ahead.
I want to just kind of level set us on a couple of things that are being said. And Joe, I think we can, Joe and Carl, I think we can keep using this relationship that you guys built over time and why it was valuable and what you learned from each other, which is awesome. Couple things I'm hearing. Vendor bashing, save it. Like, Carl has no interest in you telling him that his dog is ugly. If his dog's ugly, he knows his dog's ugly, or he doesn't think his dog's ugly. So telling him his dog's ugly is probably a big turnoff right off the bat. And it is with everybody. We all have that same feeling. The other thing I'm hearing there is, we're forcing people to be loyal to those not present. When you throw a jab out there on a competitor, you are forcing your customer to either defend them or to dog them. And it's not really human nature for people to dog people. So you're forcing them to all of a sudden defend a partner or a vendor that maybe they wouldn't have defended in different circumstances. The other one is, I love this. I hear reps like say, okay, how are we going to start off this meeting with this economic buyer? And after about 5 minutes, I'm like, okay, are you trying to lecture the economic buyer on their industry? Because you just told them what the landscape is, what the industry looks like. And you think you're trying to show them and demonstrate your value by your knowledge of the industry, that's actually a turnoff, is what Carl's telling us is, look, I already know about my industry. Share with me how you might know something about what we're doing in our industry and how you might be able to help us. So I thought that was really powerful. When you think about your next economic buyer meeting, and if you're starting off with, hey, let's just kind of show them what we know, show them what we know about the landscape, it's probably not going to hit right. Did I get that right, Carl?
Yeah, you did, Cap. And what's the value? What is the use case? You know, and again, as the economic buyer, both an executive, but quite technical too. So in my 30 years, I like to say I can smell through most things straight off the bat. Right. So it's interesting what you say about vendor bashing. It not even that for me. It's part of our process is we're going to go and assess, right? Just because you tell me you're great, there's a process. And you all know that. I'm sure your audience knows that. So it's just an instant. You know what it is, Cap? It's desperation.
Yeah.
It was always a desperate like starting point. It's not positive in any way, right? It's not helping me. And you mentioned about knowing, I call it putting lipstick on a pig, right? When you know you've got something. And especially in cyber, there's evolutions and generations of tech, right? And things decline, yeah. And new things come up. I know that. So ride the positive wave initially with me, right? Let me figure out, the pigs and the dogs or whatever analogy you're using there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well done.
Hey, so Joe, you went and did a bunch of homework. It sounds like you talked to a number of vendors that also called on Carl's company. And when did you feel like you reached the point that you had enough information to take a compelling viewpoint to Carl to start to discuss the issues that you thought his company had and try to get some feedback?
Yeah, I wanted to, make sure I had an accurate value pyramid built out. Right, that calls out the business initiatives and what tech initiatives underlie those business initiatives to drive them home and drive the value. We knew right away we were going to have to speak with a dozen and a half people before we would have a relevant message for Carl, because his initiatives are so much different than any of the other customers that we had had. You know, he was supporting 300,000 users, 1 million endpoints. So it was a very, very big undertaking. But once I felt we had a solidified value pyramid at 3Ys that we were able to get from the tech ecosystem, right, it was a compelling case for Carl that wasn't your vanilla and bland first meeting deck, right? It's like, this is what Citi's talking about in security, network, end user, cloud. This is why we think we can help solve for those problems.
And Johnny, he went pretty quick through that. Would you just, for the audience, a lot of people hear about value pyramid. You threw the 3Ys in there. Could you just do like what you mean by that? Like, what is a value pyramid? What are the 3Ys? We talk about it a lot, but I'd like it in this context, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So you want me to take it, just re-answer the question and dive into the value pyramid a little bit?
No, just kind of at the top level, you said a value pyramid, just like at the top level, what is it? How do you use it? And then you threw in there the 3Ys, just like there's some people that might not know what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a value pyramid is a way to show a unique differentiator that you've actually done your homework and know what executives and the business care about for what, the security team and network team are building behind. If you're not making a conversation about the prospect and what they're focused on, you're just going to sound like, another vendor walking in, positioning their product instead of positioning, as a way to solve for the problems and help accelerate the business for what they focused on. We made sure we built out a solid 3Ys, which was why change, right? Why is the current infrastructure set or solution set, right, causing challenges to the business, right? Why my previous company, how we were unique in the market as opposed to other vendors without batching them, but calling out our unique differentiators, and why now, right? What is the ROI? What is the value you guys will see on day one with this company?
So Carl, Joe walks in, he's got a value pyramid talking about your corporate objectives, strategic initiatives, how his product might work in a specific use case, how it might solve some of your particular pains, how he's uniquely differentiated. You start to realize, hey, this account executive is differentiating himself from the rest of the salespeople that come in here. Now, what type of questions are you going to get ready to ask Joe about, you know, his product and his company, and as a also as part of that, because you said like he was armed with information he shouldn't have had. I'm sure you're curious as to how he did so much homework.
Yeah, and at the time, I didn't know how, to be honest. So remember, at the start, it's a very professional relationship, I would call, right? Friendships build over time. So that would be another kind of element of I'm not your friend initially. You know, we're building something. So what Joe had managed to do, though, through obviously reaching out and gathering his intel is a couple of things. One, and I like how he just put it, what makes us unique? You don't need to bash the other vendors. I'll figure that out, right? But yeah, what makes you unique, number one. Number two, he clearly articulated how that uniqueness would pivot into some of the initiatives that we had going on across all of the businesses in the city. So very big that I was ultimately key accountable for. But the third thing that they had done in that initial meeting were they had helped, they had shown that they had an understanding of the multi-discipline, multi-team.
Yeah.
Joe mentioned it, networks, end user, server, internet, cyber, right? So I'm kind of one pillar, but ultimately it was a cyber-driven project. But one of the key things, whether it was by accident or I like to think it's through a methodology, Joe, but he was the only one who talked about the end user experience. Mm-hmm. So often in cyber, you know, I hear it all the time, certainly in my career, of too many agents on the endpoint, too much overhead, get out of the way, we got to do business, cyber people, you're in the way. And he managed to articulate the advantages to each of those kind of big other stakeholders that I could use internally. So in other words, even in that initial meeting, he was starting to help me articulate the why internally. I need you all to remember what I've realized since leaving Citi, I was an internal salesperson. Yeah. I had multi-business, you know, trading, fixed income, equity, consumer, private bank. I mean, global in over 150 countries. I had to get buy-in through the CISO kind of organization for any initiative we were doing. So the fact that he had managed to do that and articulate how I would go about getting the buy-in, certainly from some of the key tech stakeholders, was quite unique. And I've often said it was one of the best engagements I've had in my career from the start.
So that differentiation that Joe brought to the table initially, you started to look at him not as an account executive at some software company, but you started to look at him as a potential partner, number one. And what I'm hearing is he was starting to give you information as to, which was starting to get your wheels turning. This sounds like a pretty good idea. And if I'm going to sell it, this person's also giving me some of the ammunition I'm going to need to sell this internally.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely, Mac. But what I would say is from the get-go, because of that prep and the approach, remember, it comes back to a partnership. So immediately I was starting to feel a trust. And I want to kind of get into that. I didn't feel at the time that Joe was trying to sell me anything. And I know that's weird because I took a meeting for a particular vendor. But what I mean by that is he was playing the long game, right? He wasn't playing the, let me get a quarter. Yeah, the next quarter I got to hit my quota or whatever. That I never felt that at all. Certainly initially it was all about what value could his company bring to me and my company. And here's how.
He was educating you, it sounds like. He wasn't trying to sell you. He was trying to educate you on why they were uniquely differentiated and what type of value, if you struck up a partnership with him.
Yep.
And his company, what type of value they could bring to you and your company.
And I want to be clear. I think by, I can't remember which the order was, but we looked at over, my team looked at over 30 different vendors in this space.
Wow.
30. Okay. So when I put that.
All right. Well, let me ask a question then, Carl.
Get into the preaching thing and not, you know, the value selling or whatever you want to call it. I've heard it all. I heard it from 30 other vendors. So what's different, right?
So I gotta take one up for the peeps right now. I'm sitting there listening to this and I'm saying, you just said it. You've seen 30 different vendors, but yet you're looking for a partnership. You can't have a partnership conversation with 30 different vendors. So like, what is it that I can do to, let me just ask it a different way. Are you unique in the sense that you're trying to build a partnership? How many people out there are sitting there listening to this going, man, I'm working my butt off and they don't seem like they want to be partners. It's like they're treating me like a shoe salesman. Nothing against shoe salesman people, but they're treating me like something, you know? And how would you answer that? Because you have a great disposition. You're like, if you dance with me, I'll dance with you. But what advice would you give people that like they don't get that right away? It's like you're the vendor, I'm the customer, get in line.
Yeah, I think that's maybe an experience question of.
Oh, you just trying to tell me that's just me bringing that out?
No,
I'm just kidding.
No, but I've seen it. But over my career, it's very apparent I can't be successful without vendors, and there's a whole bunch of reasons why. And it's not just the product. One thing I always say to my account exec, you know what? It's not how you are when the times are good; it's how you are when the times are bad.
Right?
There's not a piece of software or hardware ever built or developed that doesn't have bugs and issues. How do we deal with those? When my trading floor is experiencing outages, right? How do we deal with the bad? That's partnership, right? And so I think there's a culture thing here as well, Cap. You know, in case your audience hasn't picked it up, I'm a Brit. I do see different cultural kind of things in kind of different parts of Europe and certainly in the US where I've seen the arrogance, right? I've seen that. I don't understand it because my success ultimately is based on vendors. And I can't, you know, there's a cost of ownership. I can't keep swapping vendors year after year or say 3 years are probably the average subscription cycle. It's too much cost for me. So to me, it's building that two-way street. And all I can say is it must be really hard, for your audience to try and convey that it's a partnership. But if you're only going in trying to sell a product and you're only chasing your next check or your next commission, that's not a partnership.
Yeah, you don't have a prayer. Good point.
Yeah. And if you're looking at a partnership, Carl, we usually think, at least from a sales perspective, that the customer is evaluating not only Joe, who's the account executive, and what value.
That would have been a loss right there, right? But carry on.
I knew it was in there, Joe. I knew it was in there, buddy.
But also you're evaluating because you want a partnership. You want to make sure that it's going to be successful if you implement this. You need to understand what value you're going to get from the product and then what value you're going to get from that company that's backing Joe.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, evaluating, you know, the AE, the company and the product?
Yeah. So I think we've talked about the AE a little bit, right? And first of all, there's got to be a trust. I've had AEs just lie to me. Blatant lies. The most common, and I don't understand why. I'm going to figure it out that you have truth, lie. Well, I'm going to figure it out. And there's no coming back from that. I don't have time for that. You've broken that trust. And I've had scenarios of AEs saying, oh, I met with name drop, right? Some senior, whatever, right? I met with, you know what I do? I phone them. I'm not scared. Did you? And most of the time the answer is, I have no idea what you're talking about, Carl.
Wow.
Right. And in one term, this is a true story. I emailed the CEO of the company and I said, I'm sorry, I can't do business with your company if this is how your sales and your you want me to spend millions with your company and this is the approach? And I forwarded the email chain. To be fair, the CEO did the right thing and fired the account executive, but to this day, never done business.
Wow.
So that's number one. I think number two with a Joe, and obviously you start to meet, yeah, the product and the support, and you start to get a feel of how this is going to go. I then start to kind of, and again, partnership is two-way street, is a joint success. So in my role, and it was a very big role, obviously, I was able with my team to have big influence into features and things like that, which are great for me because it means I'm successful and I get what I need for my company to be successful and I get it first. But then what it means to a Joe and their company is they can pretty much turn around and resell all of that, certainly in the same vertical, because everybody's chasing the same thing in a particular vertical usually, be it regulatory or the next thing or the next challenge. We're not that different. It's just some of us are maybe ahead and some of us are a bit behind. So it enabled them to then outpace their competition because they would go in and say, oh, we already have all these feature sets for financial. And the competition didn't because they didn't have the value of working with us and working through the challenges, right? So it's a joint success there from that perspective, Matt.
Yeah. Now, as a CIO, you got to have hundreds and hundreds of issues that you could address, right? And then how do you and your team, one, prioritize which issues to address? And then maybe after you address them and you come up with a plan for next year or a plan for the quarter, whatever you came up with, you get someone like Joe to walks in your office and says, I think there's another issue here that wasn't in the plan. Can you talk a little bit about, one, how you go through the process of prioritizing? And then two, what happens if you need to make a change to that original plan because a good salesperson like Joe walked in your office and addresses, you know, an issue that your organization has?
And that's one of the best days. But so on your first part there, I think any company of any size, small, medium, enterprise, global, as a CIO or as C-suite, you're supporting the business strategy. It's not Carl's cyber engineering team, right? It's the company's engineering team. And what am I doing to support the line of business and what they need? So ultimately, that's a prioritization from a what I would call net new investment, right? Of and if you think, I mean, it's been an amazing journey from data centers to cloud to mobile or internet first, right? And then as the business would pivot to consumer experience, customer experience, having it on mobile and right, loads of cyber challenges there. But that's generally what it is. The second part of you as a CIO is what I refer to as IT hygiene. So you have to prioritize your end of life, your patching, your asset management, right? It's the boring stuff, but it takes time and effort and money to get it right. And then the third thing, certainly in a regulated industry like I was, is you're looking ahead at the regulators. So what do you need to do, right? They're almost setting the timeline for you. I often heard that a bank is really a technology company with a banking license.
Yeah.
Great way to think about it.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, yes.
No bank on this earth is going to exist without tech. So that's a great way to think about it. And the regulators, certainly again, in the cyberspace, initially, not great at looking ahead, but certainly, in the last few years have been driving regulations that you probably need 2 or 3 years to plan and break out. So they're really your pillars of priority. And then the curveball that you just threw in, which for me been a bit of a tech person as well, is when you find that new thing, that thing that nobody thought about, that new approach, that new thing like we have here at Deep Instinct where, and again, it comes back to how does it align? How does it fit? within the business strategy, but generally cyber is underpinning most businesses these days as a foundational layer. So you figure it out because you generally have a bunch of money that you can move around. And at least having worked with startups for almost 20 years now, right? You don't need a lot of investment in these smaller things to prove them out initially. So what I would call a production pilot. So it's not a full purchase. It's a great way of cheaply kind of getting something in, proving it in the environment. And then guess what? Everybody gets excited about it internally, and then it becomes a priority for the next year. And this comes back to account executives playing the long game, right? Mm. I don't always have money quarter to quarter because I've already got my priorities for the year. But you play the long game, it's much more reward.
Do you have examples,
and that's where you
Carl?
Can truly test the product, the account executive, and the company at the same time when you go into like a, what you call a production pilot.
Yep. Yep.
We can get to test all three of those, the values that they're going to bring before you decide to go big.
Yeah, and what I would say, the account executive relationship is key. I'll give you a great little story. I had an account executive at a company that got acquired by one of the big boys, and where it went to die, and he ended up getting a job at a company I'd never heard of. We had been researching this space for 3 years, and he phoned me up one day, and we'd done great work together. He's like, Carl, got a new gig. Can you just help me? Would you mind taking a call with the founder and the head of sales? Or, I'm like, sure, Sam, why not? Right. I did that because we had the relationship and the trust and the partnership for years. And he turns up, wheels him out. You know what? That was a small startup. We ended up spending about $30 million with that startup.
Wow.
They had that unique thing that I remember saying I'm to the founder, I'm like, your marketing sucks, because we'd been researching this space, like I say, and we'd never found or heard of them. But it's a great example of how that trust and partnership of one, they move over, I'm willing to help. Right. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. That joint success. Right. And it's just a great story because it turns the relationship, the innovative tech, and the aha. And pre-production pilot is what we did first. And eventually we rolled it out globally.
Do you have any examples, Carl, of you didn't have time to do a pre-production pilot? You saw something and you basically had enough information at what it was doing at other companies, similar to an environment like yours. Because what I'm hearing a little bit is, get it in pre-production, you get it next year. And I know everybody on listening is like, they're looking at their forecast right now and they're going, I'm screwed. There's Joe, you with me? Joe's shaking his head down there. So do you have examples of where you looked at something and you said, okay, we can pre-produce it and do all that stuff, but I'm telling you, based upon what I see in the marketplace, now that I understand this problem and what others have done with it, I think we got a roll. Can you tell us a little bit about where do those things meet?
And this comes back to, and I've said it, joint success and partnership, right? And the trust. So what I want to say about the trust from the AE side, from the Joe side, right? Tell me what's going on in your company. I know it's not all roses. Tell me what challenges you have. Hey, Cartier, help me manage your CRO, right? I'll manage them for you. Mm. Hey, I don't have money for XYZ. This is what I'm looking at. I'm willing to make those calls and help. I think of one example, and again, trying not to mention names specifically, but let's just say that the deployment would have been in line. So it would have been very disruptive, a lot of change control,
yeah,
a lot of testing needs to be done, right? And this particular technology, it was an IPS, right? An inline, back in the day. And so it was really frustrating for me that people couldn't see the value. So you know what I did? I made it out of line, right? But that was a joint thing with the AE and a couple of the engineers. And I'm like, hey, if I can avoid the business disruption by just feeding it, so even if it breaks and we make a mistake, the business carries on, but I can now go in with the value. So
you built your proof points.
We built, yeah, but it was a pivot, right? The other thing, I'll give another example, network admission control. I'm sure it's a very hard technology to deploy because it's, if you deploy it correctly, it's in line and it's very disruptive to your business. And if you want to do a whole nother podcast on that, I can tell you why. Yes. So we had an aha moment, and I remember it clearly over a coffee. And I'm like, you know what? Let's just deploy it globally, but let's not have it do anything. Let's just gather data as to what we would have prevented and what it would have found. So that whole pivot around trying not to be disruptive to the business, but getting the value.
So did the vendor give you the solution, Carl, or did you have to buy it? How did that work? You're skipping out the good points. Everybody at home is going, did somebody buy something?
No, and it's a great point. So I was very keen on the there was a smaller company at the time, very keen that they need to make some money, right? So it was again we did a deal of I bought X, I can't remember how much it was, and if I then went and deployed it globally, that would have been discounted off the price, right? That's awesome. Ultimately how we did it. But they gave me enough to prove out the data, and as soon as I had the data points, it was a nirvana. The other thing was if you're going to deploy something in line, that deployment is very slow because it can break and it's very slow. Now, what does that mean to me and to a Joe is I buy it and now I've got to go and deploy it, and it's going to take me 18 months in a big company, certainly, right? Now you've got to give me some incentives around, I need another 18 months because I'm not getting value out of your product until it's deployed, right? So being able to pivot and maybe do a visibility approach, the deployment is so much easier. Why? Because if the product doesn't work, remember, bugs and issues always exist, right? It doesn't matter. It falls over. The business carries on. Nobody's complaining. Right. But I'm getting data that supports a sales motion internally as to the value prop of your device technology and how it fits into my overall strategy.
And Joe, let's bring Joe and John and John Mack in. Okay, now we're going back to our companies. And we understand when you say inline, you're like, that's going in production. It's going to affect people in their jobs. Like, that's how I'm taking that away. Out of line means we won't have too much disruption to the business. We can feed it and get some proof points. So, Joe, now I'm sure that you have some examples of, and for me, this is always, it's always pipeline discussion. Like, these are great ideas unless you don't have pipeline, Joe, right? And you're like, I'm in it for the long game, bro. I'm with you. But if you don't have pipeline, then this is a kind of a mute point from a seller's perspective. But Joe, how do you go back to your company? You've worked out this partnership, and let's say you got your company telling you, Joe, you got to go get that deal. Joe, you're not tough enough to ask for that deal. Now, I'm not saying that that's out there, but let's just say by chance it is. And, we need this deal, Joe, and you got to go do this and do that. How do you play the long game, Joe? How do you bring it back to your company? And then maybe Carl, how do you help Joe? You see Joe needing that. How do you help him? So Joe, you go first and then Carl, fill it in.
Yeah, I think there needs to be transparency internally at a company about how a large global bank operates. Our product is fantastic, but they do have their procedures and their policies for how they evaluate new tech and onboard new tech and understanding what those timelines realistically look like. I don't want to, mislead anybody internally to, add extra heat on me from a forecast perspective. I want to understand almost like I'm an extension of the prospect we're selling to, so I know how they operate and how I can forecast that internally. But I think it goes back to trust and building trust. We were fortunate in my previous company to avoid the production pilot. And why was that? When, tensions heightened with Russia and Ukraine, I don't want to violate any NDAs, but Citi needed some additional support from us at the time. So we had our C-suite on the horn, working weekends, ensuring that we were able to assist them, right, to build that trust and ensure that we can provide value for their org. And once we were able to make that deposit, you know, we knew, I felt that I had enough sweat equity built up to ask for that withdrawal, right, for a large global deal. And, you know, again, great mentors internally that I've mentioned before, you know, Dolly, Mike, Ernest, David, Mark were on the horn almost every day supporting that and ensuring they knew what Citi was trying to accomplish. So, yeah, it's all about transparency and trust.
And then, Carl, for economic buyers that are listening, you know, you've said it a couple of times, and I think it's awesome. I don't run into it all that much, but like somebody who's willing to put the seller's hat on and say, okay, I know this is probably going to be difficult. Let me help you. Let me help you help me, kind of like, could you kind of fill that the gap in on that?
Well, you mean from from a Joe perspective of helping?
Yeah, you know, Joe's going to have to go back to his company and do something maybe different than they do it. How do you help the seller do that? Or how? Yeah. What are some things that you ask the seller to contemplate to help them build their story?
So, I think it depends on the company a little bit and their size, right? Smaller companies are more sensitive to delays, for example, than larger companies. So, yeah, that's number one. Number two is really working and making sure, because as Joe mentioned, their internals are, we got all the procurement and we have all the formality around that, right? So this is, again, that coming together and you build a trust over time and you're a bit more transparent. And then, to be honest, Cap, maybe start getting creative. Like I gave a couple examples of how, right, I could foresee blockers, I could see delays, I could see, it's going to take me a year to roll it out. So that's going to have a negative. So yeah, brainstorming on those kind of things to get creative and come up with, and I'll be honest, the formality, sometimes they didn't like the approaches of, purchase a little bit and then it gets applied to a discount. But, you know, there was a few times, I don't always get it right, Cap. Right. There was definitely a couple. I remember one example, probably spent about $5 million on something that we rolled out into North America, but not the rest of the world. And then ultimately we didn't see the value. Wow. We probably spent 3 years on that. But did purchase, I think it was $4 or $5 million worth, to roll it out. And everything looked great. We were kind of surprised that ultimately, and again, no need to get into detail, but didn't add value. And so it doesn't always work. There is a, from my perspective, internally, I, as Joe's kind of lining up and doing the research, I would line up stakeholders. So depending on what the value prop and whatever it was, before I went in and made a pitch to change a strategy or to add a strategy or to remove a vendor or whatever, I already knew at least half of the stakeholders were on board, at least in principle, with the idea and stepping forward. The last thing I want to do as an economic buyer is go into a, I'll call it a procurement meeting, right? Yeah. Or a strategy meeting. And you've got, I don't know, 10, 20, it's a death by committee in big companies, right? You got 10, 20 people around the table. But you know what? For the particular thing you're doing, there's probably only two or three that you need on side. And the rest of the room will follow. So that was my homework with the help of people like Joe, right? Hey, how would you in other companies, right? So I worked at Citi. What did you do at JP? What did you do at Ernst & Young? What did you do at Schneider, right? So they can give me their experience to help me be successful internally as well. And again, it comes back to that partnership. It's a joint success, right? If I just want to buy a product, I don't need to talk to anybody. Google's my friend, right? That's not what this is about. If you're just chasing the next commission, right? I don't need that. I have subscription services that I can turn off with a month's notice, right? That's not the role of an account executive.
Right. Hey, Joe, you went in, as Carl said, in the rare circumstance where you got a meeting with Carl without a champion. Can one you talk about why you didn't use an internal champion to Carl to get the meeting with Carl? And then, Carl, can you talk a little bit about the types of people that you might rely on inside your organization to bring you a vendor you know, with a solution to a problem, and what makes you trust them and rely on them?
Yeah, so Citi's very, very close to the chest, right, when it comes to all technology initiatives and honestly discussing pain, right, and challenges and what they're focused on. Luckily for me, we had great alliance partnerships in the tech world that had been successful at Citi. I did know about one tech alliance where I believe Citi made a nine-figure investment in, right? And there were value adds that, you know, Zscaler, my previous company, could bring to that investment. So working with their teams and just really doing the research on how deployments are going and, you know, ensuring we educate the partnership, because they're meeting with Carl once every 2 weeks, right? Ensuring those vendors are going, you know, to evangelize for us and make deposits for us, building them up as champions. You had to really build champions in external parties that weren't even Citi before you felt you were ready to position yourself to Citi. So again, probably 20 to 30 different discussions across tech ecosystems before I had my first meeting with Carl.
And then how did you get that meeting with Carl if you did not have a champion sponsor?
Tell the true story, Joe. Tell the true story, man.
Well, no, I mean, I have to ask the question because the audience is going to be curious as to how he did that.
So it was funny. Obviously, he was on my radar, and I know he gets hundreds of calls a day from vendors. I was fortunate enough to catch Carl on a cold call, and he didn't know Joe Lynch from home at all. And he says, yeah, I know Zscaler. I know the CEO, Jay. I'm going to reach out to him when I'm ready. And then actually 2 weeks later, right, after sending Carl some documentation, Carl reached out to Jay, who was the founder and the CEO that Carl met probably 10 years ago, right, when Zscaler was a Series B or Series C company. And then Jay looped me in, and we had kind of our first discovery session together.
Okay, gotcha.
So you had the patience, Joe, where the that was a win for you when the economic buyer says, hey, I know your boss, I'll reach out to him. And then how many people would not be patient enough and think that that would be like a bad thing? How did you stay patient enough? Like, how did you prepare your CEO? What did you send to Carl after that conversation to add value to kind of keep it on Carl's radar?
Yep. So there are three big business drivers that Citi was looking to implement and accomplish. So I had data sheets on those, on where Zscaler can provide value in those initiatives and business drivers. For example, a thing like cloud adoption, cloud migration, et cetera. So having him ensure that he has some documentation on Zscaler and where we can assist his efforts, and also them communicating with my team about, you know, internally presenting the value pyramid to, you know, my CEO at the time, right? What we've learned from all those discovery sessions. So we're having a very, very, very tailored discussion to Carl Froggatt about his global bank instead of all about Zscaler.
Did you know he was going to call him, or were you thinking he's not going to call?
Well, I was hopelessly optimistic at that point. But once I saw an email come in, I was like, okay, I think it's go time. And then we had a bit of a sales cycle under us, but it was a great start. I mean, there was a lot of sweat equity built in, you know, prior to that first discussion. And to see the kind of hard work come to fruition where Carl was even impressed, it was all worth it. And again, I owe that all to my mentors that have taught me that process that you guys built.
So Carl, I want to weigh in there a little bit, right?
Because funnily, I thought I hung up on Joe initially, but apparently not. That was my recollection anyway, Joe. I think this comes back to understanding who you're selling to. There was a timing element here that was a little bit fortuitous, even though Joe will say it took far too long. I had a problem. We had a strategy gap, right? I had a gap in what I could do. Funnily enough, we had a solution from another vendor that they promised all those stakeholders internally would work, and it clearly didn't. But there was a timing element here of Joe doing the right thing. He obviously did all his research that I did. I had no clue about, but it was aligned with my priorities at the time, right? And I think you just said it, or Max said, right? He was patient.
Yeah.
Right. One of the worst things for me as a EB is if you try and do the runaround, right? You know, start calling people, I call it, can you, and actually had somebody say, can you do a campaign on Carl? Right. We got to like, right. So I'm like, if you as an AE can't have a conversation with me and kind of get things across, then what do you think all of this kind of shenanigans is actually going to help your cause? No.
Johnny, right. Dig in there a little bit, Johnny.
Well, yeah, so Carl, most of the times, salespeople are, let's say, sponsored into your office through people that we call champions, people that have either like deep technical domain knowledge in the area that we're trying to sell to, or the past decisions that they made inside your company has, you know, they've earned your trust through that, through purchase decisions, good implementations. And now they bring a problem to you with and they're sponsoring a meeting with this salesperson. Are there champions that you depend upon to get your job done? Not only one, to understand issues that might need to be resolved in your company. And number two, in an implementation, you can't run the implementation. So don't you need champions in your organization to help you ensure that there's a successful implementation of the product?
Yeah, I was responsible for everything from innovation and look, in the innovation, lots of failures, right? The whole point is fail quickly, all the way through to operations. So somewhere in the middle there is implementation. I think the short answer is yes. There are plenty of people internally and externally that I'll say were champions and that I really valued their opinion and trusted their opinion. I think as the EB, so what I would generally say, and it is a bit of a generalization, is what is their motivation, right? Mm. So there could be other motivations at play. What I generally see, for example, if you're talking to somebody who deals with endpoints and servers, they have a slanted view of endpoints and servers, and you can solve everything with endpoint products, right? And so you have a champion in networks, guess what, everything can be solved by the network, right? Yes. So and if you have a champion in, I don't know, API security or identity, well, guess what, right? We don't need networks, we can solve everything with identity and zero trust. So as my kind of role, it was also getting a broad viewpoint and trying to understand the motivations, because we all have bias, we all have blind spots and whatever. I think hopefully that kind of helps answer your question a little bit, Mac, right? Yeah. But it's not necessarily one person.
But it's also not everybody that reports to you can knock on your door.
Not at all. And look, most things, especially in the tech world, they're not isolated to one group. Right. And certainly in cyber, but even
almost everything's collaborative in the tech world, right?
So I would say cyber touched everything. Identity, endpoint, servers, network, cloud, right? Like the cyber touches everything. Networks touch everything, right? So again, there's a motivation thing and there's a timing piece. So if the champion came to me and said, hey, I need the I've saw this thing and there's this guy called Joe, right? And it would be, maybe it's a priority for them because that's what they need. And I have a slightly different priority, but you know what? It's somewhere on my list. Well, maybe we can work together and figure it out. But I would generally say I would challenge my champions too, the people that I trust, right? What's their motivation? Why now? Is it something they need that I can help with? I will always pivot back to where's the value prop for my business and my company ultimately, right? And like I say, timing is part of it. I hate to say it. I buy a hardware, seven-year depreciation on the asset. 7 years, right? So if I just bought a whole bunch of stuff, it's really difficult. Just for, even if I think your thing is the best thing ever, financially and from the accounting, but really hard to make a, it's just a timing thing. But this is where you start to get creative with how can I at least introduce a little bit, right, to start feeding a change in thought internally as the economic guy.
Yeah,
Johnny, can we're I not take even.
What's that? Go ahead, John.
I was going to say, we're not even close to scratching the surface here, bro. Like, I wrote down some notes. We're talking about before you get engaged and the discovery. And then we got to talk about like during the pilot or the offline or the online, validation, how do we communicate with the economic buyer? Then we got to talk about afterwards and, how do you utilize that relationship to go deeper into the account and then use Carl to reference. So we have to have these guys back because we're not even scratching the surface on the first one. But Johnny, I'll let you kind of wrap up on what you want to talk about, but I want to let them talk about deep instinct because I'd be remiss if we didn't, here's a couple of people that are killing it out in the marketplace and they all wind up at this place called Deep Instinct and my buddy Eddie Carter, and there's a lot of cool people there. So we got to hear about what's going on at Deep Instinct. So Carl and Joe, there's obviously so much more that we want to talk to you about. And we've already just kind of agreed through our eyesight here on Zoom that we're going to bring you back and make a little series out of this because I think it's just awesome. But I want to talk to you about, like, I know we have a lot of, a lot of friends that have gone over to this company called Deep Instinct. There's, Carl, this big, powerful in the industry. He winds up at Deep Instinct. Joe, you're at Zscaler. You wind up at Deep Instinct. Will you guys kind of, you can start, Carl, what's going on at Deep Instinct where you jump in over there?
No, I'll go first and then because I think Joe followed me. So as part of my role, we used to test a lot of innovative technologies ahead of their time. Examples, Palo Alto Networks, Forescout, they were tiny startups and then they went IPO. So that's probably the exciting part of my role. And we tested Deep Instinct at Citi for a good 2 or 3 years. And Deep Instinct is the next evolution of threat prevention. So malware, ransomware prevention. We saw ahead and we're seeing in the news and the headlines every day. So we saw ahead about how the bad actors are just getting better and better. Generative AI and the tools that they use to create phishing, to create deep fakes, to create malware and ransomware. These tools are like, we've never seen such tools in the hands of bad actors before. So they used to have frameworks and whatever, and they were with the current technology out there is okay against these kind of things. But now the bad actors have got this new generative tool set based on AI, and it's crazy. So we saw that that trend, if you like, coming years ago, and we were testing various innovative companies, and Deep Instinct I had in my threat lab, along with all the other kind of main vendors in the space. And this comes back to the value prop, right? I continuously tested to see if the things that I were buying were actually doing the things that I expected them to do, which was to protect my company. And the results were quite shocking over time. You would see a big fluctuation in how good they were at stopping threats. And that fluctuation came down to two things: how new and unknown the ransomware was and how it was delivered. And Deep Instinct was just this solid flat line at the 99 point whatever percent. And I'll be honest, it took me a little while. I had some other priorities going on. And I was like, how can this be? Like, I've got all the other things and I see them fluctuating wildly. And it's really based on our technology, deep learning. And we're the only company that does it. And this is the reason I left my career to join Deep Instinct and help them grow and take this amazing technology. And now we have a platform. So it can be embedded in cloud, applications, storage, endpoint. It can be embedded anywhere in a defense in depth stack to mitigate all known and new and unknown threats. And nobody else can say that they do that today.
Awesome. Joe, how'd you get him out of there, Joe? Because I'm assuming you recruited him. You recruited him.
No, I was first. I recruited
him. Oh, you were first.
Oh, okay.
Wow, Joe, that says a lot about you, dude. He recruited you there.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm a firm believer in people, product, and process, right? And, you know, from a people perspective, you know, the most important P is, you know, am I going to go learn? Am I going to go learn from people who have been successful in their roles in the past? Am I going to repeat that success? So for me, it starts with the C-suite. Our CEO, Lane Bess, has a, you know, very distinctive eye for disruptive and innovative technology. He was the CEO of Palo Alto back in 2007 when they had 15 employees, scaled that to IPO and tremendous success. He was a COO at Zscaler when we were a Series C company, right? Scaled that to tremendous success. He actually retired for 5 years and did his own investing when he discovered Deep Instinct. And he was so blown away by the technology, he decided to, as he'll call it, get off his couch or his mega yacht and get back in the seat to scale us to be the next great cyber company. Carl, right, his background with Citi Ventures, you know, Citi was the first global financial to adopt Palo Alto in 2008 through that relationship with Lane. I know he's always got an eye for disruptive and innovative technology. So, you know, from those two, I could learn a lot. And our CRO, Ed Carter, right? His success at BCE speaks for itself. His success at Zimperium speaks for itself. So from a people and product perspective, I was sold, right? And then from a process, Ed's done a great job in building out a value-based framework that we're now seeing a lot of success with a lot of the global financials that I cover. So it's three Ps, and it's working out pretty well.
Well, thanks, Carl, and thanks, Joe. Thanks, Cap. And we're going to have a second episode on economic buyer, determining value on the implementation, and what other post-sales things you need to do with the economic buyer. So thank you, Carl. Thank you, Joe. And thanks to everyone for listening to another episode of the Revenue Builders Podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Be sure to check us out at forcemanagement.com.